Welcome to the first in an all-new series of Steve's Speed Shop here on Fab Radio International, brought to you this time in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. We've brought back some of your favourite features from the first series, like The Greatest, and tonight I'll be asking which was the greatest British sports car of the 1950s. Was it the Morgan Plus 4? Was it the handsome Austin Healey 104? Or was it the legendary Jaguar XK120? And I think I might just have answered my own question there. We've got a new feature called Rated or Hated. Tonight, it's the Lamborghini LP610-4. And it's the Frankfurt Motor Show with all kinds of fabulous new cars. Frankfurt is the big one. There are new cars from Rolls-Royce, from Bentley, and from Porsche. But one of the most eagerly anticipated new cars is the Jaguar F-Pace, Jaguar's first venture into sports utility vehicle territory, and it was launched in spectacular style. Now, one of the most anticipated cars of the year has been the new Jaguar F-Pace, quite controversial in some circles. It's Jaguar's first SUV. It was launched at the Frankfurt Motor Show, which is going on right now as I speak, and it was launched in rather spectacular fashion. In fact, it was the most spectacular launch of any car in many years, was it not, Mr. Terry Grant?
Yeah, it was a little bit special, wasn't it? It was better than just pulling a sheet off the car, that's for sure.
Yeah, back in the day, if it had been the XJ6 or the XJS, they would have just had two girls in high heels and bikinis. And in some ways, that was disappointed, although, of course, the motor trade has put all that behind it, if you'll pardon the expression. Just tell the people what you did the other day, Terry, and which Guinness World Record you now hold.
Yeah, it was a mega achievement. 6 months of planning has gone into this in secret. Obviously, because of the car, and, the press and everything around it. So everything I had to do was totally secret. NDAs, pieces of paper going left, right and centre. And we put the F-Pace through the biggest loop-the-loop in the world. So we brought that Guinness World Record back to the UK. It was held by a couple of drivers in America. They done it for Hot Wheels back in 2012. The loop then was just over 18 metres. And on Monday evening in Frankfurt, we managed to do a loop-the-loop that was over 19 metres. And just to give you some idea of the size of that, next time you see a block of flats, start counting, and when you get to sevens, and that's where we were.
Seven stories high.
Yeah.
I was going to say, where does an idea like this come from? But I think I know, because I think I was there. I think you guys originally had this idea when we were at Oliver's Mountain, Scarborough, 2 years ago. Would you be telling tales out of school if you said, yeah, that's where it all started?
Well, mate, yeah, there's been discussions, and they've been going for a long, long time. But, yeah, it has to start somewhere. And as far as I know, back beyond further than that, so the PR director from Jaguar, he was playing with his kids, and the kids had the Hot Wheels loop out. And that kind of got his senses going, and then it went to the next stage and the next stage. So I'm sure in their eyes it's been planned for a while, but they literally gave me the green light and the budget about 6 months ago, and yeah, we've been working on it ever since.
Right, I'm going to embarrass you now, because we are good mates. You're the best precision driver I've ever worked with, and I think one of the best things about the way that you work, Terry, is that you're not just a wheelman. You are a mechanic, you're an engineer, you're a builder of the props that go along with the stunts that you do. I know you as a kind of an auteur of precision driving, if you will. You're like the sort of Steven Spielberg. You want to do everything. How much of this was Terry Grant? How much of the idea, and you did the driving, but this giant, giant film set, if you will, that you had to drive on, how much of that was you?
Yeah, I was kind of heavily involved in a lot of it. There was a big team of people. There was probably nearly 200 people behind this stunt. So it was a massive team effort. I worked very, very closely with Imagination, who were the guys who put the show together. And we had the budget. We had to sit down, and it started way back. So first of all, it started with the structural engineers and the mathematician to work out the math and make sure that it would work. And
was Terry was work, there, Terry was there an well, architect? Did something this side?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're telling us it's seven stories high. Presumably there had to be an architect.
There was an architect, a structural engineer company that they're called MLM, massive big structural engineers based out of Ipswich. There must be 200 people in their office. And I kid you not, Matthew, the guy that worked this all out for me, and I swear he's in his early 20s. When I went and sat down with him, and I trust him impeccably because his boss was the guy who worked out the very first loop of the loop I'd done back in 2010, which was only 8 meters high. So I trust them impeccably. We went and sat down with them. Matthew sitting there with a great big piece of paper, a pencil with the thinnest lead that you've ever seen, like an accountant, and a calculator. No computer. And literally, it was, we couldn't tell him what the car was. We knew the weight, we knew the dimension, the wheels and stuff like that. And we handed it all over to him and literally sat there and tapped away in his computer and started writing things. And I'm quite clever, but some of the...
No, you're not.
Some of the calculations...
you wouldn't have got in that car if you were to...
No, I know. I'm obviously not that clever. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been in there, would I?
This guy sounds like Ben Whishaw's character Q in the Bond movies. Is he a bit like that?
Like that, but literally 22, 23 years old. The most unassuming, nicest lad you're ever likely to meet.
Oh, the exact
there in a suit, and it was brilliant. And literally 5 minutes, went tap 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 tap, and he went, yep, there you go, 53 miles an hour, you'll be fine.
Let's talk about the car, Terry. It's a much anticipated motor, expected to arrive in showrooms at least here in the UK. I'm not sure about the states. Next Easter,
early 2016 is on sale. They're taking orders now, and literally you can be driving it by the beginning of 2016.
Priced from around £35,000, which seems very reasonable. Pitch between the Q5 and the Q7, if it was an Audi, rear wheel drive or four wheel drive, petrol, diesel, manual, automatic. The top spec lifted its 375 brake horsepower supercharged V6 from the F type. Which one did you do this? Stunt in, Terry? Close was it? Come on, how close was it really to the car?
I kid you not, right? And this is what makes this whole gig so special. So, up until this point, every loop that's ever been done in the world has been built with a specific car built from the ground up just to do the loop.
Yeah, or a space frame desert raid buggy.
Absolutely. Or a car that's been totally butchered and built from the ground up. We totally turned that on its head. They literally gave me two cars off of the production line, and we converted them to do the loop. But every single part on that car, the suspension, the way it fitted, was as it come off the thing. We beefed it up a bit so that it wouldn't break, because it's 6.5G when I hit the ramp. But that is it. Every single component is the original component on that car.
Special tyres, Terry?
No, absolutely not. Stock as it comes off the production line, Pirelli tyres, stock wheels, honestly, stock everything. We've had to beef up the suspension because of the hit, but literally the suspension is the original suspension. We've just assisted it so that it wouldn't collapse. So that's the only time I've ever driven a loop car with suspension that actually worked. So it worked up until the point where we were in the loop and then it gets blocked out. That is it. Everything else was, and every other car has always had literally solid suspension. The suspension struts come off and there's just literally almost a scaffold bar in there normally so that nothing moves.
Yeah.
We didn't want that, and we did not want that. We wanted that car to come down the runway working on suspension, floating like it would do, and that's exactly what we did.
So, Terry,
I'm
fascinated to know, and I've got my own theory, which is the theory that I think most people would have. Rear-wheel drive or four-wheel drive, surely four-wheel drive would be helpful in this situation. You're now going to tell me I'm a massive idiot and it would make no difference at all.
No, if you look at it on paper, absolutely, four-wheel drive is the way to go. And to be honest, the other things that helped as well, the car's aluminium, so that helped get the weight down. So we took weight out of the car, i.e. seats, dash, and all of those things that we didn't need, but we didn't cut big lumps out of the car. The shell is untouched. The windscreen is untouched. We removed the side windows and replaced them with a lighter, safer thing, obviously in case something went wrong for me. So there was Lexan windows in the side. That's it. Everything else was stopped. Obviously, there's a roll cage, a special seat, and harnesses, and fire extinguishers, and we changed the fuel cell and stuff like that. But that, you know, it was built like a racing car. That's it. That's all we done.
What was the most unusual modification that had to be done to the car? Was there something that just made the whole team, except for the person who insisted on it, go, what? We've got to do what? What about the seatbelts? Did you have to modify the seatbelts, Terry?
Yeah. So the seatbelts were out. I was in a five-point harness. The race seat in there was a special seat built for me just in case. Because at the end of the day, looking at this, if, you know, the worst happened and I come flying out seven stories high and land upside down, you know, we needed to make sure I was protected as possible. So the modifications that went on were just, they were safety things to keep me safe.
I've thought of a couple of things. Airbags, surely to goodness, a hit.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, they had to be disabled or removed from the car.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, disabled or removed, or either or. But I kid you not, the brakes were original. The steering was original. The steering wheel was original. All of those things were absolutely stock original. I even had air conditioning in there because it was so hot sitting in there waiting to go. I turned the air conditioning on and that worked perfectly.
Did the radio go off when you hit the loop?
No, it took the radio out. Yeah, that was gone, but the air conditioning was brilliant.
Now, Terry, a Formula One driver like Lewis Hamilton, who you know is your neighbour, isn't he, Lewis? You and Lewis are neighbours. Yeah. Strange little trivia fact. Yeah. Terry Grant is Lewis Hamilton's next door neighbour in Hertfordshire, lovely Hertfordshire. But Lewis Hamilton might be expected to withstand, 5G in a particularly severe corner. You and the car had to withstand what, Terry? A bit more than that, yeah?
Yeah, it was. It's quite funny, actually, because the person presenting the whole stunt was Martin Brundle, who does F1. And obviously, he's very, very, very knowledgeable on F1 and all of the facts. And he actually knew the answer to this, because when we told him that when I hit the ramp, I hit 6.5G. And he went, well, the guys in F1 hit 5.5G when they're really on it on the brakes, you know, from 200 miles an hour. I said, so that's another G more than any F1 driver's likely to ever feel. So he was really impressed with that.
Sorry, so can I point out something which some people may feel is a little harsh, bearing in mind that you successfully completed this? You're not exactly a spring chicken, are you, pal?
No, mate, but I do, I do look after myself. I look after my body. I had to go in training as well. I had to make sure, you know, the things that a 6.5G hit is severe. So I had to get in training for it. Like I say, I stayed pretty fit anyway. But the big thing is making sure that all my bodily organs stayed in the right place. So that's what,
Terry, this is a family show, please. Your bodily organs.
But it's a fact. I had to train for that.
Did you wear a compression suit?
No, did I? Hell, I just went for it. But I got into training, and this happened a long time ago when I first started doing loops, because the very first time I ever done it, literally for 2 days when I was going to the toilet, there was blood.
Wow.
So that's how I knew that, you know, and then I was told, yes, all your body organs have just got shaken around in your body. You need to know how to control them. So I had to go off a long time ago and learn how to do that. And you ask somebody to do it in the street, they won't know. They'll pull funny faces and they wouldn't have a clue. So it's a really difficult thing to do. But thankfully, I'd done it many years ago. So I just literally got back into training and was down the gym and doing all the things I needed to so that I could take the hit, you know, with no drama.
In a world, Terry, where big corporate concerns like Jaguar Land Rover would seem to be, on the face of it, increasingly risk-averse, this was, let's recognise this, it wasn't just bravery on your part, although it was incredibly brave of you to do it, mate, and I salute your... I'm surprised you managed to get your get your attributes into the car, even though I'm sure it has got a lot of space inside the new Jaguar F-Pace. I mean, that took some balls, what you did, mate. But it took some balls from Jaguar as well, didn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And when we actually done it on, when we done the reveal on Monday night, the weather turned. We were in Frankfurt. The weather turned in the middle of the afternoon. I was due to do it at 8 o'clock in the evening. About 4 o'clock, the heavens opened, lightning. The storm was that bad, they closed the airport. So Frankfurt International Airport was closed for all flights for 2 hours while this storm came through, and that was less than 5 miles from the location we were in. And it did not stop raining until about 6:45 at night. And you can imagine everything was soaking wet. Literally, I had a meeting with them. Obviously, the worst thing for them was if I'd done it and something gone wrong, you know, they didn't want that. So they were ready to pull the whole thing, just show the guys inside a movie, not even let them see the loop, and they wouldn't have known any different. So it was really, really brave. They listened to myself and my team that was around me. We had a plan. If it was raining, we implemented it. And literally, we had 50 people 3 minutes before the curtain dropped on their hands and knees with paper towels wiping the surface for me so that I had an approach and I could get up to speed.
So 6 months of planning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dieting, yeah. Training, yeah. Designing the prop, setting it all up, 200 people.
Building the cars. Exactly.
I'd ask you about the money, but I think we'd all recognise that it was way in excess of six figures. It's got to be.
Of course it was. It was a big budget reveal.
Very big budget. What were you, Terry Grant, thinking and feeling sat in that new Jaguar F-Pace at the end of that runway, waiting for the signal to go?
Yeah. Believe it or not, I kid you not, I was the calmest person out of everybody there. Because I knew I could, I won't do anything I know I can't do. And I knew I could do it. I knew I could do it. So for me, honestly, I really was, and you can ask anybody that was on set, but I really was the calmest person there. Everybody was petrified, including my engineer who was on radio talking to me all the time. So I'm sitting there with my crash helmet on and he's there to calm me down. I was calming him down. I turned it completely on its head and I had to calm him down. He was down by the loop and he was nearly sick, bless him. I felt so, so sorry. So I was calming him down and telling him everything was going to be okay.
And it was, thank goodness. Finally, Terry, watching the video, which is all over the internet, and we've pinned it to the top of our Steve Speed Shop Facebook page as well, so people can see it there. Tell me if I'm right or wrong. A lot of people will think that you just pointed it and pointed the car and pushed the throttle. I think I could see you steering on the loop. I could see you steering on the loop.
Yeah, if you watch the video back and look at that, I was steering on the loop and I was steering away from the loop. I actually corrected two or three times in there. So it's far from just hold the throttle down and go through it. It's just impossible. Bear in mind, it was still soaking wet when I was approaching. So I had wheels spinning. I had the thing stepping out sideways and I had to obviously change gear, get into second gear and make sure that I hit the magic number, which for me was 53 miles an hour.
53 miles an hour.
So, I really, really had to.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, pal, if you hadn't hit 53 miles an hour, you could have found yourself going back to the future pretty damn pronto, couldn't you?
Honestly. and more facts about it, which makes it even crazy. So 53 mile an hour going in, a 6.5G hit. When I'm completely upside down going through the top of the loop, the deacceleration is that severe. I'm only doing 15 miles an hour and the tyres are, it's 0G, so the tyres are just coming away from the surface when I'm upside down at 15 mile an hour. And if you tell all these facts to someone, they go, no way, you're not going to do it. It's impossible. So it was a big stunt. It was a really big stunt.
Well, I know you. You're also the hardest working man in show business. Where were you this weekend, Terry?
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. So this happened Monday night. They took me off to Frankfurt Motor Show to reveal the car on the stand. They played the movie and then they lifted the drape like normal to the rest of the press around the world yesterday. Literally, I flew back this morning. I am now driving up to Aintree to do a corporate day tomorrow for Halfords. So I'm there tomorrow. I'm then driving back down the country to Millbrook, and I'm on crash testing duties at Millbrook all day Friday. I'm then in near enough in Cornwall at a friend's wedding for a TV show called Don't Tell the Bride. And I'm delivering the bride and her father to the church for a wedding on two wheels in one of my cars. And literally, I go straight from there to the ferry port, travel through the night, and I'm doing an air show in the south of Holland
well,
on Sunday.
Not just the best precision driver. Not just the best precision driver in the world, but also the hard work, the most hard working. Terry, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Well done, mate.
Thanks, mate.
No worries. Thanks, Terry.
We're going for the Guinness World Record of the world's highest loop-the-loop driven by a car. And I'm eager to prove to everybody we can do it. The Jaguar F-Pace is definitely the right car to take on this challenge. So we know the car's good. We know the loop's good. It's going to do it. I know it's going to do it.
Listening to Steve's Speed Shop on Fab Radio International in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. Time for a new feature now, Rated or Hated Tonight. It's the Lamborghini Huracan LP610-4. Cool. So, Rated or Hated, the part of the show where we drive a car, a newish car, in this case, the Lamborghini Huracan, to give it its full name, the Lamborghini Huracan 610-4 Coupe. We decide what's the benchmark car in the market prior to its arrival, and we've decided that that car is the Ferrari 458 Italia, and I talked to somebody else that's also driven the car to decide whether it's rated or hated, and today that's Chris Rees. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Steve.
I reckon, Chris, that there are three things that people say when I find myself in the fortunate position of being able to smoke about in a new car, which is obviously what we do a lot of the time. And the three things that people mainly say are, core look of that, bearing in mind it's new and it looks amazing. How fast is it, mister? And blimey, how much is one of those? Although they don't always say blimey. I bet it cost a bomb. Is what people normally say. So let's take core blimey look at that. The Lamborghini Huracan. Does it look enough like a Lamborghini, Chris?
Well, it's certainly dramatic, but it doesn't have the kind of hang it all out there feel that Lamborghinis of the past had. So, you know, it doesn't have the kind of Richard Grant body kit and huge picnic table spoilers everywhere that you could say that... Perhaps some Lamborghinis of the past used to have.
Good thing or bad thing, though, because I think when people... There's a lot of talk in relation to the Huracan about traditional Lamborghini aesthetic values. I don't think there's any such thing. I don't think you can look at Lamborghini as a company. I was in JD Classics in London's Mayfair only last week where they had one of the original cars. They had, Mr. Lamborghini's original motors. What an ugly car it was, the one that predates the Miura. Is it the 400, the 400 GT, 4000 GT?
That's a car I actually love. I'm going to put this out. I really think that's a great-looking car. But, you know, each to his own.
It just looks like a clumsy Lancia or an ungainly Maserati to me, that car. It was only really with the Miura that they hit their stride. But that's a bit like saying it was only with Sgt. Pepper's that the Beatles really hit their stride. I mean, that's one of the greatest cars of all time and one of the greatest looking cars of all time. But surely to goodness, we can't look at the two most significant cars in the history of Lamborghini in terms of aesthetics, the Miura and the Countach. They don't even look like they came out of the same company. They don't look like they came out of the same country or the same factory. So what are traditional Lamborghini aesthetics?
Yeah, well, the Gallardo kind of redefined things, didn't it? Because it was kind of crisp, modern-looking thing.
Origami school of styling, wasn't it? It looked like it was created from a piece of crisp white A4, that design. Were you a fan of the Gallardo's looks? I found it a bit restrained myself, a bit too tasteful for a Lambo.
Yeah, ish. I think you could say the same thing about the Huracan. It's very, very colour sensitive too, I would say.
Oh yeah.
The one that I drove was matte black, or as Lamborghini like to call it, Nero Nemesis. And it looks just wrong.
Looks terrible. That matte black one that they're smoking about. Maybe it's an age thing. I'm 51 years old, Chris. Maybe I don't get it. I want my Lamborghinis to be one of two colours. I want them to be outspan orange, like the most juiciest, brightest bright orange you can imagine, or I want them to be Kermit the Frog green, and those are the only two colours that I ever want. Maybe fly yellow, although that's a Ferrari colour. I'll tell you what other colour a Lamborghini shouldn't be. It shouldn't be Rosso Corsa. Why on earth would you? The one that I drove was Rosso Corsa. It looked great, but to me, when I see the bull on the front, I want it to be a Lamborghini colour. And I, again, probably because of an age thing, I think, yeah, it's got to be green or it's got to be orange. And then as it buzzes by, even at its top speed of 202 miles an hour, you know that is a Lamborghini.
Exactly. Yes, you want a Lamborghini to burn your retinas out with its paint scheme.
Nice.
And luckily, they have all of those three colours, orange, yellow and green. They're all available in the Huracan, and you should buy it with those colours.
And damn right too. A nice place to be, isn't it, as well? Very sophisticated on the inside. A proper difference from back in the day. Remember that crazy offset driving position, Chris?
In the 1970s Lamborghinis, your back would be ruined within the first 5 minutes in the banana shape.
Why did they think that that was ever okay? You know, that's why Rod Stewart kind of always sits down when he performs live now, because he spent so much time in the 70s and 80s sat in Lamborghinis where you had to kind of move you orientate your whole body. You almost have to it's hard to describe, isn't it? There are more comfortable bosun's chairs than the perch and the Lamborghini from that era. Very different now, of course. Stalkless steering wheel and that amazing 12.5-inch display in the absence of instruments. For me, all the stuff inside as well, the cues back to the cars we've already talked about, Diablo, Countach, Muera, Uraco, Yalapa, Silhouette. I've just remembered what the other one was called. All those Lamborghinis of yesteryear, all those cues in there for the old petrolheads like me and you, but also a very contemporary place to be. Reminded me a bit of the Millennium Falcon inside that car.
Yes, it's kind of, the whole thing is designed to make you feel like a jet fighter. The steering wheel with all its seemingly hundreds of buttons. The starter button has a kind of red flap over it, fighter style. Hexagonal dials.
Yeah. It's like a starter button arms race, isn't it? Because now that I think I got in it was a Renault the other day, and rather than a key, it had a big red starter button. And I thought this was once the preserve back in the day of racing cars, then in more recent times of supercars. Now it's appearing on a relatively modest two-door Renault coupe. So Lamborghini have had to up the ante, hasn't it? It's almost like It's the Top Gun button, isn't it? You pull the flap back, you press the buttons, and you shoot down the MiG-21. That's what we're doing here, aren't we?
Yeah, well, they have got it right. That bit's fantastic. Although, speaking about buttons, the one thing I would say is it's half Millennium Falcon and half Volkswagen Polo. They've put buttons in that come straight from Volkswagen.
Oh, you're not going to whine about the fact that you've used VAG switchgear, are you?
I just did, and I'm sorry, that does bug me.
I always remember
a car that costs £180,000. You kind of would like it to have.
Yeah, but them's the brakes. We'll move on to that in just a minute because we're going to do Blimey, How Much is One of Them. I bet it cost a bomb in just a second. But first, let's move on to How Fast Is It, Mister? And the answer to that question, of course, is 202 mile an hour top speed. From the V10, let's not forget, a V10 engine in the Lambo, 5.2 litres with a new 7-speed transmission, and the old single clutch automated is now a dual clutch automated manual. An automated manual. All kinds of new terms for the rather more mature car hack like the pair of us to get used to, aren't there, in this modern world of ours, Chris?
Yeah, but I mean, this is the way the world is moving. You can't buy a supercar with a manual gearbox anymore. It has to be these flappy paddle automatic gearboxes.
Well, it's all about the transmission with this new car, isn't it? It's the same engine. It's that 5.2 litre V10 that we know and love from the Gallardo, which is the best thing about that car. But the worst thing about that car was the transmission, and that's been completely sorted. The old single clutch 6-speed is now a dual clutch 7-speed, and it is just it's just divine, isn't it?
It's mental, yeah. On the one hand, it's like an automatic transmission. You can just jump in it and drive down to the shops completely happily in traffic. But, you know, switch the right buttons to the right places, and you've got the most amazing kind of, you know, Formula One-esque transmission at your disposal. It's fantastic.
And normally aspirated, of course. I think, is this the way forward now? Do we really need to artificially induce the fuel into the modern supercar? Are the days of superchargers and turbochargers, apart from the hypercars, which will, I think, always need banks of artificial induction devices to force them to use as much fuel as they need to do the insane speeds that they do in at this level, surely to goodness that's it now for superchargers, turbochargers or anything like that? Good thing or a bad
thing? You might say that, but in fact Ferrari, which has a naturally aspirated engine, the 458 Italia, is just about to switch over to turbochargers in the 488, which is the new one, and McLaren's gone turbo. The only one that's sticking with normally aspirated is Lamborghini, and I say good on them, because you can't replace a good naturally aspirated engine if you want sharp throttle response.
Oh,
if you want that fantastic sound,
it's just
it
incredible
has to be that.
And I don't care if Lamborghini have engineered in this pop and crackle on the overrun when you take your foot off the throttle. I don't care if they say, oh, we've just put that in there, we've reprogrammed the ECU or the computers that are on board to make it do that just to impress the owners, buyers and idiots like us who get to borrow them. I don't care if it's artificial. It's awesome.
It's awesome. I think we will look back on this era of natural aspirated engines as the golden era. It's about to disappear, but Lamborghini's sticking to its guns. So if you like that sort of power delivery, and you should, it's the best way of delivering power, go and buy a Huracan, because it's the last chance you'll get.
I can't get anyone, Chris, to tell me how fast this car is to 60 miles an hour. The figures vary from just under 3 seconds to 3.5 seconds, which, of course, is a massive difference. And I wonder if it does vary from car to car. I wonder, Chris, if perhaps the good people at Santa Gata have perhaps given us journalists some cars which are a little bit hopped up from the standard one. Although, of course, that's never happened before, has it?
I don't know what you're suggesting.
Well, people in road tests, people are turning times. I saw in America, very well-respected American car magazine. No, there are some. And they turned the time of under 3 seconds at the drag strip. I think, but they were in like Arizona or somewhere like that. So that, you know, you can, if you walk on the drag strips in Arizona, you have to walk like Frankenstein's monster. You have to almost drag your foot off the tarmac. It's that sticky. So maybe it was more to do with with geography and climate than it was to do with anything else. But we're basically talking about a car which, in perfect circumstances, can turn 0 to 60 in under 3 seconds, will top 200 miles an hour. These are magic numbers. But the most impressive one for me, Chris, the quarter mile in 10.5 seconds. That's proper fast.
Yeah, it's stunning, isn't it? And a 0 to 124 miles an hour in 9.9 seconds. I mean, these are astonishing figures for a road car. You know, this is the entry-level Lamborghini as well, let's remember.
So we'll move on to, which is exactly what I was going to move on to next, which is, blimey, mister, how much is one of them? I bet it cost a bomb. Again, we're in trouble here because you could spec it up, but it's not like maybe 10 years ago where you could add massive numbers to the cost of a so-called entry-level supercar. A lot of things come as standard. I think for $183,000 as we speak, you get the carbon ceramic brakes as standard. So what do we think? Do we think, especially against the Ferrari, which is the 458 Italia, almost identical money, does the Lamborghini Huracan LP 6104 look like a bargain, look like an absolute steal, or does it look a bit pricey to you, Chris?
Well, it's obviously going absolutely head-to-head with the Ferrari in price terms. And, you're right, there's a lot of stuff on the Huracan as standard, whereas in the Ferrari, you really can tick the options boxes and it goes mental. I had a drive of a 458 where Ferrari had specced it up with over £100,000 of options.
£100,000 of options on the entry-level car.
Wow.
Did it have the two-tone stitching on the seats? If you actually look, that adds like thousands and thousands of pounds.
But it's nuts.
Yeah, the entry-level car, as it is, with the carbon brakes as standard, all kinds of things are standard that you didn't used to get as standard. And here's the problem for me. Does it make the flagship car, does it make the Aventador, does it make the flagship car look too expensive? Is it so good that the problem it's creating for Lamborghini is it makes their other car look too expensive?
Yes, yeah. If I would say the Aventador has got the aura of being this kind of really on-edge type thing, so you might buy it for that. But it's the same with Ferrari, it's the same with Lamborghini. Their entry-level cars now are so good, really, that is the car you should be buying. You should be ignoring the other stuff in the range.
Exactly. And that's what I think. So it seems almost pointless, but I'm going to ask it, Chris. The Lamborghini Huracan LP6104, is it rated or is it hated?
Oh, rated for sure.
Oh,
definitely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the only one that I'd be looking at as an alternative was the Spider, which, of course, has been unveiled in Frankfurt this very week. And I think, bizarrely, and I wonder why, for the same price as the closed car. Exactly. We're in a world, Chris, where the ragtop, the convertible, which was always, always, always more expensive than the metal roof car, is the same price.
Yeah. Different markets, I think, completely. That's the poser market, isn't it? If you want a car with a roof off.
Absolutely.
You want to hear people saying, "Whoa, look at that," as you go past.
Across the world, the real alternative, FabRadioInternational.com.
Time for the greatest, when we take 99 cars, pit them against each other three at a time in an attempt to find the greatest motor car since the inception of internal combustion. Tonight, we're asking the question, which was the greatest British sports car of the 1950s? Was it the Morgan Plus 4? Was it the Austin Healey 104? Or was it the Jaguar XK120? It's time for The Greatest, that part of the show where three men bicker, argue, debate and sometimes come to blows in an attempt to find the greatest motor car since the inception of internal combustion. We have three people, one of which is always me, and we have two experts. This week, it's Guy Loveridge, the chairman of the Guild of Motoring Writers. Hello, Guy.
Hi, Steve.
And the well-known racer, collector and restorer of all kinds of motor cars, Jonathan Turner. Hello, Jonathan.
Steve, how are you?
I'm good, sir, but which Jonathan Turner is the greatest from these three cars, the Jaguar XK120, the Morgan Plus 4, or the Austin Healey 104? We're trying to find the greatest British sports car of the 50s.
Stop. The Jaguar. It's a no-brainer. Oh, everybody knows it. This radio interview is over. It's the Jaguar. I have a Healey. I love my Healey, but it's a Jaguar. A guy knows it's a Jaguar. What's the Morgan doing there?
The Morgan's there because it's the plucky, British, independent, four blokes in a shed with a plane and a rivet gun. That's why the Morgan is there. It's the great
still
British tradition.
Still trying to make a good car. still trying. Still making an effort. That's good point.
They're still trying. The Morgan Plus 4, the more powerful and slightly longer version of the Morgan Motor Company's 1950 4-4, made between 1950 and 1969. They revived it in 1985. Guy, was it ever really any good?
It was. The Plus 4, using the Triumph TR2, then 3, then 4 engine, grew into a car that won its class at Le Mans in 1962, the Plus 4 Supersport.
Yeah, but that's like the Skoda Rapide winning its class in the RAC Rally. It was the only car in that class.
No, it wasn't. It beat the AC Ace. It beat the AC Ace in the 2-litre GT class. Come on, chaps.
Was the AC Ace still running at the end of the race?
No, it blew up.
Exactly. You see, Steve, exactly. You're right again. You're
but
right.
To finish first you must finish.
Yeah, very good point. We're getting ahead of ourselves,
as usual,
because we get all excited, three men of a certain age arguing about cars. Let's try and decide, shall we, what is the typical British sports car of this period? And I'm gonna try and put it in a nutshell. It's a car that was built for export to the US, let's be honest about that, to get those lovely greenbacks into the British economy. Sir Stafford Cripps, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, had said, had he not, in 1948, export or die, and given special exemption, he got all the good men, the great men of the British motor industry, in and said, build cars that the Americans would like. And so is that, Jonathan, really what we're asking in this question? Which British car, which British sports car of the early 50s appealed most to Americans? So it's got to be the Jag, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, I say that. I'm highly biased. I love my Jags. I've had plenty. I've driven plenty. I've raced plenty. They're wonderful. Same with Healey's. And you know, guys, right about the Morgans. You know, we could talk about MGAs. There's quite frankly dozens of gorgeous British sports cars that went across to the States. I mean, it depends how much money you want to spend. It depends if you're a family, if you're a racer, if you're a sports guy, you know, if you're male, you're female. We could spend all day long talking probably about 12 or 14 different cars that, quite frankly, in their way, were absolutely perfect.
So you're a young guy, you live in, I mean, a huge percentage of these cars went to dry states, particularly California. You're looking at a new car. You're looking at what America has to offer. We're not quite there with the Corvette. I think the Corvette's at least a couple of years off. So you're looking at what the American, what Detroit is offering you in the way of sports cars, and it's virtually nothing. It's next to nothing. You're not quite in the hot rod crowd. You may be a bit of more of a country club, Ivy League type. So what are you looking for, Jonathan? You're looking for a car that you can drive to the office, that you can drive to the country club, or you can use to participate in a bit of gentlemanly motorsport at the weekend, and you're just saying the 120, yeah?
It's the 120 because there's a fantastic, iconic photograph of Clark Gable, who was one of the first purchasers of a 120. So he was probably our equivalent of Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise, and all the kids now want to be Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise, so they're going to have what they've got. And in those days, if Clark Gable had a 120, I want a 120 because I can go to the country club. I'm young, I'm good looking, and I want to be like Clark Gable. And then at the weekend, I can take it racing and win. It was a fast car. It won. It's a very, very successful car in its day.
It's a good point, very well made, but I would counter with the fact that Don and Jeff Healey took the 104 to the States and got Tom Yule and Louise King, whose dad was Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, no less, to pose with one on Broadway. Outside where they were appearing in 7 Year Itch. And Tom's co-star from the film version of that came along as well. So you have Marilyn Monroe, Tom Yule, Louise Kennedy and the Healeys sat on a car on Broadway. Doesn't get much more of an iconic American image
Jonathan
than that.
Jonathan Turner, I cannot square in my head what you're saying here with your stunning, your absolutely stunning Healey. It's just such a wonderful, wonderful car. I was thinking that the last time we were at the Oliver's Mount Circuit in North Yorkshire here in England, which is the last true street circuit left on the mainland UK, and I've got some pictures of your car on there with no advertising hoardings, no sign of the 21st century. It could be 1954, 1955. In fact, Guy's holding up a book in the studio, which I think has got your actual car in the photo. Is that Le Mans?
Yes.
Is that from Le Mans? Yeah.
Nodge 391 and 392 at the pit counter at Le Mans in 53.
Jonathan, tell us
what.
It's a great, great car. Tell us and tell everybody else what is so great about your Healey.
Well, it's small, it's nippy, and it goes like the clappers, quite frankly. The Jags are bigger, heavier cars. They're better for long distance. They are quicker than the Healeys, but on small, nippy roads, small, nippy tracks, the Healeys are much, much better. It's got all-round discs, so you can pile into a corner, whether you're on the road or whether you're on a racetrack. You can pile into a corner a lot faster than the Jags. You know, we can move a lot. It's nimble. But it is, you feel smaller. You know, I raced it last weekend at Goodwood. Loved it, had a great time. But it doesn't feel as solid as a Jag. But it's light and it's quick. It's a sexy thing. There's no question about it. And Guy's right. You know, I'm not, well, did I say that? Guy's occasionally right. Yeah, the Healey boys did do a fantastic job. And they did a good job for England. And you made the point about exports. I mean, we were in that, you know, in those days, you mentioned Corvettes, American cars. But there's no comparison. You know, the British manufacturers of their day, the Jag boys, the Morgan boys, the Healey boys, they were at the top of the game, no question. And what's happening now? We're bringing them all back. You know, we're importing them all back. We're turning them back to right-hand drive, and everybody's now trying to find these things. But there's thousands of them. You know, they all went to the States.
Guy, is there an element of snobbery at work here? Because of these three, the Jaguar is the only one where it's their own engine. And what an engine.
Well, yes, the definitive original version. I mean, they did design a 2-litre four-cylinder for the XK120, but it never made it to production. That engine stayed in production well into the 80s with the XJ6, essentially. It is an epochal engine, the twin overhead cam Jaguar engine. But I'm going to introduce an element of reality, the indisputable thing. Sales figures. XK120, 11,778. Austin Healey 104s, including 55 S's, 14,689.
And 5,000 on here is damage
plus
to the
Morgans.
Of the plus four Morgans. I feel a bit sorry for the Morgan in this company.
Well, having pointed out that sales figures don't lie, I would also say that in 1959, there were two British versions of the sports car championship. There was the Freddie Dixon Trophy and there was the BARC Championship. Gentleman Jack Sears won the BARC Championship in an Austin Healey. Chris Lawrence won the Freddie Dixon Championship in a Morgan Plus Four. And the only time they went head-to-head was at Brands Hatch. And Chris Lawrence wiped the floor with Jack Sears at Brands Hatch in the Morgan. Arguably
the most suitable circuit
for the Morgan.
But Guy, if I'm a 25-year-old Brit who wants to go out and pull a few birds and have a pint with his mate, am I really going to buy a rattly old Morgan? Or am I going to get a sexy Healey or a sexy Jack? Be sensible. I mean, back to the point about sales figures.
Sales figures don't lie.
It's a rattly piece of junk. And, you know, you drive it, it's filled with water. I mean, what is...
Hold on a second. Have we all been to Malvern? Have we all been to the factory?
Yes.
Yeah. The legendary Morgan factory and seen them, as they do to this day, wheeling half-finished cars between the ramshackle outbuildings that compromise perhaps the strangest car factory on the whole planet. Haven't we all fallen in love with the romance and the mystique and the legend that is the Morgan Motor Company? Jonathan, stop laughing.
I agree with everything you say, but are you going to put 30 grand in their pocket? What you? Great, brilliant, charming, wonderful. But, you know, Clive Sinclair made a bloody good C5, but nobody bought one. You know, famous, let's buy one of Clive. I mean, Apple now produce a watch that you can put on your wrist. Well, Clive Sinclair did that 30 years ago. That's no big deal, but nobody bought it. These Morgans are lovely and the charming, but nobody buys them for a reason.
Oh, dear.
That's pretty
harsh. I'm not going to say it, but you know what that reason is.
What about at the time? Are we fair? We're trying to find the definitive British sports car. I think we've nailed what it was actually for and what it needed to do. It needed to appeal to the sort of sporty young guy who wasn't part of the hot rod crowd. Later, of course, Detroit would try and cash in with its own so-called sports cars.
The T-Bird, etc.
Yeah, and the be more affordable versions of the cars that we're talking about from Triumph and MG. But it's really hard to in this company to find a car other than, I think if we'd opened it up to the rest of Europe, Jonathan, particularly, was there anything? Well, when we
don't
talk,
bring an Italian, not interested.
The only thing that I could, or German,
356.
A 356.
They
really
sold shed loads in America.
Yeah, but it's a sports beetle, isn't it? It's like, yeah. Do you know what the only thing? Right, here's the thing. I'll tell you something that can compete. I love the Healey. I've driven quite a few plus four Morgans, quite a few, not like you, Jonathan. XK120s, but I've driven quite a few, and I've never owned one. I'd love to. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful car. The only thing I can think of that would compete with an XK120 for my money back in 1952 was a Type R Bentley or a Vincent Black Shadow. Because they're the... Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that in this company, the only thing that has the quality, the thoroughbred history, and the great looks and just the money, no object build quality of an XK120 is either the fastest motorcycle in the world, the Vincent Black Shadow, or the fastest four-seater car in the world, the Bentley Type R.
Yeah, that's up Continental, and I'm very, very lucky I've got one of those. And now that is a stunning, beautiful car. And
I hate him!
I get you on this. We're British, right? We're British, and we're proud of our country. It's like having a conversation about, would you rather fly a Spitfire or a Mustang or a Messerschmitt? You're going to fly a Spitfire all day long.
Yep.
Yeah, but I think...
Fine stuff.
Here's a point. Let's stop bickering if we can for just a minute, just a few seconds.
Tricky.
And say, when we're talking about the best British sports car of the early to mid 50s, what we're essentially saying is the best sports car in the world, aren't we? Yeah? Guy?
Yes, probably.
Ferrari haven't really got into their stride. Maserati are making GTs. Aston, where are we with Aston
Sports
at this
Coupe.
Time?
DB2.
DB2, yeah, DB2. 4, Mark 3.
Oh, that's an ugly
car. Yeah,
they're
big, heavy.
Oh, that's a big, ugly car.
Yeah, that's a big bus. It's a big bus.
You could see the David Brown in that car, couldn't you? It was a bit agricultural.
Yes. Yeah, you're dead right.
So, right, gentlemen, let's call this ramshackle debate to an end, and ask you to rate these three cars in order of desirability, quality.
Unfair.
It's not at all. So, you first, Guy Loveridge. 3-2-1.
3-2-1. Morgan plus 4-3.
We've hardly discussed the Morgan. I think it was the red-headed stepchild.
For obvious reasons.
The red-headed stepchild in this conversation.
Despite the fact that I own the 1953 London Motor Show plus 4 Morgan.
Go on.
I'm contextualising it. If I was, as Jonathan said, back in the day, going to spend my hard-earned, it would be Morgan in third place, 120 in second, and the 104 first.
Jonathan.
Oh, you're such a journalist, aren't you? You've got that completely wrong. Because you're going with the sales figures, because that's what it says in the book.
Yeah.
What a load of toss. Obviously the Morgan third, if not seventh. The Healey, a very, very, very close second. Very close second for all the reasons we've been talking about. But Jaguar wins it. Who's out there now, rocking and rolling with the XF and the goodness knows what else?
I only didn't go Jaguar because the 120 never came with disc brakes, and that was its Achilles heel.
Right, well, I'm gonna give people my considered opinion for what it's worth. I think the Morgan in third. I love Morgan. I love what Morgan represents. It's like a Moulton bicycle, or it's like I was going to think of a Vincent motorcycle to me. It's
a
just something
jacket.
Which is I'm not sure about that. Ineffably British. It could only ever be British, but very much in third place in this company because the other two cars are so fantastic. I think the choice between these two in 1954 was the choice between the two best sports cars available anywhere on the planet at the time. I hadn't driven a Healey 104 till last week. I didn't know whether I was going to enjoy it or not. I thought it was a fabulous, fabulous motor car. I managed to find an example, completely untouched, original paint, original into everything original, completely original. Spent most of its life in Australia, which is why it was still in one bit. And I just adored it. And so previously, it would have been Morgan 3, Healey 2 and Jaguar XK120 way out in front. But I'm going to reverse that. I'm going to put the Jag in 2 and I'm going to put the Healey first. But it's not up to us. It's up to you. Go to our Facebook page, Steve's Speed Shop. You'll find the three cars there. We want you to tell us which is the greatest British sports car of the mid-1950s. Is it the Jaguar XK120? Is it the Morgan Plus 4? Or is it the Austin Healey 104? That's it for the first one in an all-new series of Steve's Speed Shop, brought to you in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast Bookshelf. See you back here on Fab Radio International next Wednesday at 7 p.m. UK time.